Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette, Jessica Fletcher's favorite podcast. I'm your co-host, Bridget Keys, and I'm joined today by Frank Berman. Frank is an occasional host of Secret Cinema at the Maple Theater in Bloomfield, Michigan, which is where we met. Frank has hosted, among other things, a James Bond series at the theater. He's appeared on episodes of the podcast Screen Drafts, introducing their Teacher's Draft and Vietnam War Draft. And of course, we think Frank is super cool because he worked in Capitol Hill for a few years and now lives in Michigan, where he has a career focused on data analytics and, more importantly, watching 80s television. Frank, welcome to the Cabot Cove Gazette.
Hey, thanks, Bridget.
Don't forget about what line? I just saw your chat message.
Oh, no, the outline, I mean.
I don't have one for the... Okay. Great.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to put this in the recording. So, Frank, I have no outline for today's podcast episode because we are discussing season 4, episode 7. If it's Thursday, it must be Beverly, which is hands down my favorite episode of the entire series. I think it's hilarious. I think it's campy. I think it's amazing. I think it does all the things a cozy mystery should do.
Yes.
And because I love it so much, I've seen it a million times. And I sat down to watch it for this recording, and the note that I made was, I love this episode so much. That's it.
That's
so
it.
This is going to be a bit of a free-for-all.
There we go. I don't mind. That's what the episode represents. It's just a crazy free-for-all, you know. All hands on deck. This is like absolutely like a lot going on in Cabot Cove that no person realized what was happening.
Yeah. Okay. So let's dive into maybe starting with the plot. So we have the night deputy, Jonathan, who we've never seen before.
Nope.
He goes out because somebody's cat is stuck in a tree. Somebody's dog goes missing. He has all these reasons that he keeps getting called out on duty.
Very typical
of a small town.
Yep.
Yeah. And while he's out, his wife ends up being shot to death. So obviously it looks, and his radio was off, so it looks like he did it, right?
Yes.
She was an alcoholic. They had fights. Seems like it was a domestic affair. But of course, he didn't actually do it. What he was actually doing was doing all the women in Cabot Cove.
Yeah. Yep. Typical Jonathan.
I love this episode so much because Murder, She Wrote is... Well, especially the Cabot Cove episodes can be very puritanical about things like sex. And even within this episode, we see as Jessica and Amos are investigating what Jonathan's been up to, and they're slowly starting to uncover, like, oh, he had an affair with Eve Simpson. Wait, he also had an affair with someone else. Wait, every single night of the week he had an affair with somebody. Like, you can just see them getting shocked and more scandalized, right?
Yeah. Well, Papa was a Rolling Stone. There you go. I just summarized Jonathan.
I think my favorite moment is when they figure out who Thursday is, Beverly, as the title indicates.
Yes.
And everyone else has been like sort of skirting around their relationships to Jonathan. You know, I was lonely. He was handsome. He was helpful. I've been divorced. And she goes, it was good, clean sex once a week. And Amos and Seth are like, oh, hell no, we're out of here. Like, we cannot handle this conversation.
No. And like Cher Tupper's like, I don't want to go into that beauty salon anymore. You go in first, Jessica. Like, I'm kind of like
there are horrible things that happen in that salon that I cannot be a part of as a man. It's so good.
It's like its own cult though, but it's not actually a cult.
Yeah.
Per se.
Loretta's Beauty Parlor. You think it's a cult?
Yeah. I say it's like almost like a sex cult in a way though, but not like.
Didn't know it was.
No,
that's the best
it wasn't.
Part, right?
Yeah.
They were all part of the same Jonathan sex cult and had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to like not think about sexual safety to enjoy this episode, right? Because if you start to think about that, it starts to get really gross and unhygienic very quickly.
No.
But like, I love the opening scene where we see them all at the beauty parlor and everybody's gossiping and joking and laughing and it's hubbub. And then after they all find out they've all been sleeping with the same guy, it's like dead quiet and miserable, right? They're just like, I hate all of you.
No, exactly. It's like where the whole like town commences. I mean, just for the wives and ex-wives, too, just to bicker and do what they want and gossip.
Yeah.
I mean, like, even like in the like the very first scene when Jessica's getting her hair in like the background, one of the characters is like reading, like, oh, look at these popcorn balls. You can make them in the Cox. Like, okay, what? Can we rewind that? Like, yeah, something's going on.
I mean, it's interesting to me that they were all such good friends and had no idea that how did it never come up in conversation that they were having these affairs?
Yeah.
I think that's really weird.
Yeah,
and
that
then the part
true.
That I thought was extra weird, whereas like the Loretta's assistant, Corrine, the young one who's like super shy. And I feel like it's the exact same character in Steel Magnolias, right? She's like shy and wears glasses and quiet and mousy. But then she's like been hearing all these women gossip
like
about
Hannah.
Jonathan and is like, oh, I better go see what Jonathan's about, right?
Exactly, like the Daryl Hannah character in Steel
Didn't
Magnolias.
Didn't she feel that way to you?
She
It
does,
felt like
yeah,
exactly like, the same.
Once you mention that, yeah, it does. You can see like all the similarities. She's shy, timid, has the glasses.
Yeah.
So she's cute, like, but not like attractive, like she's going to like dye her hair permit or anything like that to style her up. But just like the way she, like her natural beauty, she just looks good the way she is.
And she sort of gets overlooked by everyone, but then she has her moment to sort of come out and shine, you know, which in this case is like, well, I'm going to do what you guys are doing. I'm going to invite Jonathan over and tart myself up, you know? So Jessica and Amos find her in like this low cut top and she's not wearing her glasses anymore. And she's like, she's living large now.
Like I said, it's like good old Jonathan, you know?
He's not even that handsome. That's the amazing part.
Yeah.
He's sort of a doofus. He's just kind of like an ordinary guy, but.
I mean, it's too bad none of like Jessica's other like attractive cousins wasn't in town during the time though, but that's just another story. That's just my perspective.
The part that I didn't remember, even though I've watched this a million times, is that he also had an affair with Loretta, the beauty parlor owner, because Loretta to me is so lesbian coded, right? She's this like deep husky voice and short hair. And she just seems like separate from all the sort of feminine gossip, even though it's all happening in her space. And we're told that actually not only did he have an affair with her, but like she was obsessed with him. She harassed him night and day, wanted to marry him. And I'm like, what? Like Loretta is so clearly a lesbian. What?
I know. I mean, like back in the 80s, I mean, that's what it was. You know, you couldn't like come out or anything like that. I'm just talking about the character per se. It's just like, oh, wow, Jonathan, you know what? I'm going to put all my like girl energy into this guy. I mean, he's like, he's just like a typical, you know, I can flip the switch for him, put it that way.
Loretta's like, I'll go straight for Jonathan.
Yes.
I mean, I guess narratively I understand because the whole point is that like everyone in town has the hots for him except Jessica. She is the lone woman voice of reason.
Yes.
So we need Loretta to also be, you know, subject to his charm, his spell. I get that. But I think the actor, the haircut, the voice, like she just reads so lesbian to me that I'm always shocked when I just like, oh, wait, her too?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we know that it wasn't, even though she was obsessed with him, it would seem like she might be the murderer, you know, bumping off his wife to get him for herself. But we find out that she was off having collagen injections the night of the murder. That was her alibi.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very scandalous alibi because, you know, she runs the beauty parlor. She must be beautiful. I kind of like that, though, because it feels like very like Real Housewives of Cabot Cove.
It does.
You know, for like, the 1980s.
It does. There's like a lot of dark secrets happening, especially like with this episode. I think that's like why it's like one of the best rated in the entire series.
Yeah.
And like people like you keep like talking about this a lot. So like with that said, I mean, when you talk about Jessica, we have to talk about Jonathan's visit over to her place.
Oh my God, please. Yes.
Yeah. So basically she's there all alone. Jonathan comes in and basically just tells him, like, I believe you, Jonathan. I just don't believe your alibi. Like, what's going on? He tries to like explain to her, it's like, I was out. you know, I was by myself. And Jessica's saying, like, did anyone actually see you? No. And they both calm down. They go on Jessica's couch. She's all tensed up. And then Jonathan puts his magic spells on her, if you will, by giving her a nice back rub, like a back massage. It's like, oh my God, Jonathan, this is so good. It's like my husband, Frank. It's like, oh, thank you so much. And she's like realizing like, oh no, I think I'm falling in. Like, I think he's trying to fly me in, if you will. Yes.
Yeah.
Then the Glenn Frey, do, 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 like all the romantic music and like her background. It's like, you gotta stop. Oh my God. Yes, George, the postman, he's up front. Come in, George. What mail do you have for me? It's like, oh, hey, here's Jonathan. You guys have a lot to talk about. Scoot out of here. Thank you. Oh, saved.
I love that moment too. Yeah. I love that, like, you can see on Lansbury's face, like, the moment that Jessica is like, oh my God, this is getting sexual. Oh my God, what do I do?
Yes.
And the way the music changes when George comes in and everything just gets sped up and like chaotic, like, get him out of the house, get him out of the house.
Yeah.
It's such a great moment.
This is not my territory. Get out. Oh my God, I'm safe, George. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And the best part, we don't realize it at the time, but like the best part is that like she shoos Jonathan off with the guy who's murdered his wife.
Yes.
Because George is our murderer.
Yeah, we don't know that yet. And this is where I think we can talk about how the whole entire plot of this whole series is basically like, I shouldn't say like a gaslight though, but a good, like, what's the word I can think of? Like a diversion, if you will, from what really happened, why George actually went out and killed Jonathan's wife, was that she had the winning lottery ticket and it had nothing to do with the affairs around Cabot Cove at all.
Right. Right. Which is, I think, a very typical thing that happens in the Cabot Cove episodes. We get these wild stories about the townspeople, and then the murder is something like completely unrelated. It's like George was selling him lottery tickets from New Hampshire. As the postal worker, he was the first one to see the announcement of the winning ticket number. He knew Jonathan's wife had the winning ticket, tried to take it from her. They had a struggle.
Yeah.
She ended up dead. So I write about this in my book on Murder, She Wrote, this episode. And what I think it's like a great example of how the cozy mystery works, that we have all these people who live in such close proximity to each other, and they obviously spend tons of time together, especially at the beauty parlor, but they have all these secrets from each other they don't realize, right? Oh. And then over the course of the episode, all these secrets come out. That's so classic of the cozy. And then I think George's moment of confession to Jessica and Amos is also like so emblematic of a cozy mystery. Like, he's not a cold-blooded killer. He didn't intend to kill Audrey. He just intended to take the lottery ticket. And he's like crying as he admits that he killed her. He didn't want to kill her. He feels horrible about killing her. Like, the whole thing has just gone so wrong. And so it gives us a sense of like, although something terrible has happened in this town, there's good in the world still. Like, people aren't just purely evil. He didn't mean for it to happen. And he can be redeemed because he feels awful that it did happen, you know? So it has that sort of cozy mystery sense that like everything will be okay. There is justice.
There is justice, and there's still a lot of elderly women that need business. I'm just going to put it in those terms. Yes. It's a family friendly podcast. So take it as you will, take it as you like though. But I mean, no, it makes sense too. Like with all the Cabot Cove murders, it's like you said, it's mostly like the person you least expected. They never had a history. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they did something wrong. And it's just like their lives are changed forever in the world of Murder, She Wrote.
And also the victim wasn't very likable, which helps too, right?
Yeah.
Like, Audrey is an alcoholic who is abusive to Jonathan. They have a really fractured marriage. He's totally unhappy. She's totally unhappy. And so, you know, like, there's a sense that like George didn't mean to kill her and he's actually a nice guy and she was actually kind of awful. So it's like, it's not that terrible that she died, right?
No, exactly.
I'm not saying that as myself, right? But the logic of the episode is that, you know.
No, most certainly too, because like when you see her like last alive, she's just regretting, like, I should have married this guy. I just feel like a divorced Jonathan. This is not happening. And he just like scoots out of the house like nothing happened, just to, you know, save the cat and whatever. So, but
yeah,
I mean, surprise. So we got to talk about George again, because he is like almost could have been the Jonathan character, because when he walks into that salon, everyone knows him. Mm-hmm. It's almost like before I knew George, like Jonathan's motive, I thought, okay, George is like the playboy of Cabot Cove. It's like all the elderly women are like, all the women are like, oh my God, here's George.
It's George. Or
just like the Diet Coke commercial back in the 90s with the construction worker. That's the equivalent in Cabot Cove.
What I think is interesting about that is that we've never seen George before. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I think audiences like the Cabot Cove episodes. And it's so bizarre to me that the writers and actors did not, because all they have to do is have everyone go, it's George. And we immediately believe George has always been in Cabot Cove, and we've always known him too, even though we've never met him before. Right. It gives that sense that this is a real place with real people with deep relationships.
No, for sure. I think it's like the same thing, the same situation, every type of sitcom where like with five seasons in, we get introduced to this new character and somehow they belong to like the sitcom legacy. People known him for like their entire lives, even though they just got introduced in that episode. So it's basically like a written rule in like sitcom or even television, like logic, that somehow a new character must enter that has like a backstory that everyone knows, but the audience doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think they do that really well in the Cabot Cove episodes. And I think it makes it feel like there is a real community, and it makes it easy for the audience to imagine themselves as part of that community, which is why I think we like these episodes so much. And I think, you know, all the bickering and the secrets, that's all part of the fun too. I have to say, like, we should talk about what happens to Jonathan at the end, because it is untenable now. The secrets have all come out. He's going to have to pick one of them or none of them. It's going to be really unhappy. And so the solution is, well, his wife won the lottery, so he's going to take the lottery winnings and he's going to get out of town. It's just sort of like, okay, this is going to be good for everyone. Like, we need this guy to go.
No, they need to find a new playboy.
Do you think they will? Maybe let's not find the same playboy. Maybe we can all date different people now.
No, somewhat, I'm hoping, but old habits die hard, Bridget.
We already did that episode. We did that a couple of weeks ago.
How ironic.
So let's talk about the other piece of this episode that is what people love about Cabot Cove, which is the relationship between Jessica, Seth, and Amos, because we get wonderful scenes of the three of them in this episode.
No, we certainly
do. I love their dynamic.
No, they're great together too. Like, you know, when Amos is coming in with like the doctor's house with his like Boston Red Sox jacket, it's like, oh, what are you guys cooking? It's like, oh, I have a little bit of this. What is this? It's like calamari. What is it? Oh, like little squids. Like, okay, I'm out of here. Thanks.
Yeah. Bye. And then later in the day, he's like, I think I have food poisoning. Yeah. Because you tasted calamari.
No, so for cute. Sure.
And they're like hiding things from him. You know, they don't want to share their food with him. They think he's a mooch. And when he gets the phone call about the murder, we see them like hiding the pie in the oven together. They're like scheming to hide food from him. It's hilarious.
No. And most definitely too. I think like they're used to being like, you know, like curmudgeon and just bickering because of all the murders that have happened. It's like, okay, I'm just going to have Jessica solve it. I'll still get paid for it. Yeah. But she's going to do most of the work.
By this point in Murder, She Wrote, he knows the best thing to do is just be like, come on, Jess, I'm going to need your help. Actually, he doesn't call her that. He's Ms. Fletcher, right?
Yeah.
Only Seth calls her Jess. And that scene is echoed at the end when they have their cooking together again, Seth and Jessica. Yes. And this time they're making escargot. And they're like, Amos, you're not going to like it. You're not going to like it.
Like, try me. Like,
come on, the bread, just a little taste. Yeah.
Yeah, he puts the bread in like the pot.
And he thinks it's delicious.
Yep.
Until he finds out that it's snails, and then it's disgusting.
Yes.
I love the three of them together. But I do have to say, like, sometimes I think they're a little bit meaner to Amos than they should be. I'm like, why can't they invite him to dinner with them? Like, why can't he hang out with them? What's the problem?
I have no idea. I think we said it before. He's kind of like very ignorant of the cooking, of their other culture, of their intelligence.
So they just don't want to mess with him because they want to like try the French food and not have somebody complain about it.
No, it's like the Cabot Cove Mensa Club, if you will. We're just
Jessica
gonna
and Sethar?
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, they're just gonna like talk about like puzzles, like crossword puzzles. Like, oh, Deuce is actually a word for Satan or the devil.
Yeah, do you understand that one?
I did not.
So the Seth says he needs help with the crossword. The clue is the devil. It's five letters. And Jessica says, uh-huh. And Satan doesn't fit. The answer is Deuce.
Deuce.
I don't get it. Do you get it?
I do not get it, though. But since we're on talking about Dr. Hazlitt, I don't know if anyone listened to the last episode where I said there's a To Kill a Mockingbird connection between this and It Runs in the Family. Dr. Hazlitt's played by William Wyndon, who played the opposing attorney in To Kill a Mockingbird.
I don't remember that. Did he?
Yeah, I actually have it. Like,
I love William Wyndon.
Yeah, no, he's great. A great character actor.
He is,
But yeah, he was the one who put, I forgot, like Atticus Finch's client behind bars. Forgive me if I don't know my To Kill a Mockingbird characters.
That's okay. What we can do is just look it up and then we can pretend like we know all alone.
That's the podcast way.
What is the guy's name? I feel like it's Tom Robinson.
Tom Robinson. There you go. Tom
Robinson.
Okay,
say it again now and you can act like you knew it all along. See?
Yeah. Okay, so William Wyndon played the opposing attorney on To Kill a Mockingbird, going against Atticus Finch's client, Tom Robinson, and putting him behind bars. So with that, you got the connection between this episode and It Runs in the Family. A little bit of like tidbit Easter eggs for you, like Cabot Cove Murder, She Wrote lovers out there.
And Tom Robinson, of course, was played by Brock Peters, who's been in Murder, She Wrote, and of course was Captain Sisko's dad.
Ooh, there we go. It comes full circle.
It does come full circle.
It all leads to Murder, She Wrote.
Everything does connect. 6 degrees of Murder, She Wrote, honestly.
Yeah, no.
Did you ever watch The L Word?
I watched maybe one or two episodes and that was it.
Okay. If you watch the first season, there was this whole shtick about a chart. And they have this marker board where they chart who's had sex with whom. Yeah. And it makes this giant spider web. And the idea is everyone ends up being connected somehow. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought, wouldn't it be really cool to make a chart of Murder, She Wrote? And obviously it's not about sex. It's just about like who appeared in what media with whom. Because I think we could probably connect like all of Hollywood for the last 100 years if we tried hard enough with Murder, She Wrote.
No, that's a good idea. Do like a Murder, She Wrote, Angela Lansbury, 6 degrees of separation, like.
Yes.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. That would be like a fun thing to do, though. But that's like a good like pub game to play.
We should do that as a pub game.
Oh,
I like that.
Oh, yes.
I love that idea. Yeah.
Yeah, I got my thumbs up for that. Like, let's do this.
Let's
do this. Let's take this nationwide.
Hey, the Cabot Cove Gazette is global, baby.
Oh, yes.
We've got listeners all over the world, in fact.
Heck yeah.
Wait, now that I've said that, I want to like, let me pull up my data because I like, I've been meaning to give a shout out to people for a while because I love that we have non-American listeners.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. What else do you want to say about this episode, Frank?
No, like another thing I want to talk about is like Amos actually questioning Jonathan when they find out about the murder of his wife. He questions him at his own house.
Mm-hmm.
And he just says, you know, give me your gun and badge, you're suspended, whatever. And I'm just like thinking about the movie The Fugitive and how fortunate Jonathan wasn't like Richard Kimball, where like all the detectives just basically blamed him for his wife's murder. It's like, I didn't kill my wife.
I don't care.
I don't care. She had money. It's like, I didn't kill her. That's just what came to mind when I saw that. It's like, Jonathan, you are lucky that Amos is your superior.
Yeah.
You don't work for the Chicago police system. Be happy you work at Cabot Cove.
I mean, it's so suspicious, right? Like, his radio's off. He's out of contact for hours. His wife that he didn't like is dead. Like, it is pretty obvious. But no, he was with Eve Simpson and her cat.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Substitute a different word for cat.
I know. That's why he didn't want to say, like, what he was actually doing and, like, saying, like, why didn't anyone see you driving around town during those time slots?
But I think you're right that there's, like, especially the end of The Fugitive when Tommy Lee Jones finally catches Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And they're in the car together and he's like, I didn't kill my wife. And he's like, I don't care. And he unlocks his handcuffs and he's like, I don't care. I don't even care. Like, I'm just doing my job and I don't think you did either. And I know you're not a murderer and I don't care. And I feel like there's part of that too. It's like, look, Jonathan, we have to go through the procedure, but also like, you probably didn't do it.
No. Yeah. In the end of The Fugitive, they realized that, you know, Richard Kimball was right. He had all the, like, Tommy Lee Jones' character had all the facts. He still handcuffs him. It's like, oh, I thought you didn't care about me. It's like, well, did I say that, like, jokingly? Like, then they become good friends.
Like, and he's like, don't tell anyone.
Yeah. It's like a good freeze frame.
Yeah, that would be the Murder, She Wrote freeze frame. I don't care.
I know. Did I really say that?
You know, I just watched that, like, I guess, like, about a year ago, and I hadn't seen it since the 90s. It still holds up. It's a really good
great
movie.
It's great, like, cat and mouse game, too.
It's a really good movie. Yeah.
Like, especially with me dealing with, like, analytics, both sides are using it. Like, Richard Kimball's using it, like, Tommy Lee Jones and his, like, posse's using it to, like, decipher, like, their next move and who really killed his wife. No, it's still, like, a really plot-driven, like, murder mystery movie.
Which is not the episode that we're talking about.
No.
This is what we do on the Cabot Cove Gazette. We have these wild asides, but
no,
they're always related.
We need to bring Dr. Richard Kimball into Cabot Cove. I think that's the new Jonathan. I think we found him.
I love this episode so much. I just think it's so much fun. And
it is.
I think it's just a terrific example of what Murder, She Wrote can do when they let themselves just go nuts in Cabot Cove. And everything I've read from the writers and producers and all of Lansbury's papers, they just all are like, ugh, the Cabot Cove episodes. And I'm like, how do you guys not see what we see? Like, this is genius television right here.
It is.
This is 40 years old and it's amazing.
No, like you were saying before, you have to let the characters go loose, explore new boundaries and, like, interact with, like, different types of characters they haven't, like, crossed paths before. And then you get that dynamic like you see in movies, like, oh, Jessica Fletcher's like, oh my God, he's actually falling for Jonathan for, like, the first time ever. It's like, oh no, what does she do? How is she going to overcome it? So we like seeing those types of, like, obstacles and how they, like, overcome it on their from, like, their character perspective, since we know more about them. Like, oh my God, this is too funny for her. So it's like you said, it just creates, like, new dynamics and, like, more, like, interests with the storyline.
That seems like a pretty good place to wrap up for now. Why do I keep forgetting how we wrap up episodes? That seems like a pretty good place to wrap up for now. So Frank, I want to thank you so much for joining us these past 2 weeks as guest host. I hope you've had as much fun as I have.
I really did. I think I need to get my hair done. Do you want to go to the Cabot Cove Salon?
Hell no.
No. I think they might be looking for, like, someone new there, someone, a new male client. So I'm just going to check it out and see, like, I don't know, maybe.
I think you'd go over well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would. So
Ideal Malloy would be all over you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, most definitely. So wish me luck.
And we'll, so for the Cabot Cove Gazette, I'm Bridget Keys.
I'm Frank Berman.
And we'll see you next time. The Cabot Cove Gazette's theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We're Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and @Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.